Okay. Good morning, folks. This is the intro to AI CSC 471. I assume you're all registered for that class. There is a little survey sheet that I guess all of you are filling out. It's mostly general information about you. The first, of course, was to make sure that you have the prerequisites needed to take this course, that is some sort of a common sense. So if you have trouble with the first question, you are in the wrong class. I can't teach you much on that side. There are probably a little more than 43 people, I believe, in the class, but I'm assuming that some of you are probably not registered. We will see if there are going to be seats available. I will actually talk about what the class is today. So some of you probably are in the wrong class. You didn't want this, in which case the other people who wanted can get back in. If not, we'll find out what we will do regarding the space. Okay, so a couple of, the first thing I must say that I'm really thankful and happy that Barack Obama's inauguration speech just got over before the class started. So I hope that both you and I can actually listen to each other as again as just watching the laptops right now. Okay, I couldn't have asked for a better timing, I guess, on that one. Anyway, the general information on this course, I am Rao Kambhampati, and the office hours for this class are going to be right after the class. I think I got the wrong question here for some reason. It's going to be Tuesday and Thursday. I just put that, I got the, give me a second. Just want to make sure that I got all the right ones. I was just making changes in the last minute and I wanted to make sure that they did come through, but obviously not. Okay, good. This is the right one. See? Okay. Let me see if I can put all these right here. Okay. So the office hours are Tuesday, Thursday, right after the class, 11:45 to 12:45. TA, can you please stand up? That's Yun Sang Meng. He's going to be the TA for the class. That's good enough. He did take this course and did extremely well. Hopefully, he still remembers from fall 2006. So you are in very capable hands as far as TA is concerned. Instructor, you can't help, but TA is at least good. There may be other help beyond this particular TA. That's Yun Sang basically is the department assigned TA. He has, I think, it's 10 hours per week. And we might be able to get other help, but I'll let you know on that a little later. The most important thing is the course homepage. I don't run the course from the blackboard. Those of you who are checking your mail already know this. We have a homepage somewhere here, and you should just remember that. If you just say CSC 471 ASU, you'll get there, or you just look at my homepage, you'll get there. There are many, many ways of getting there, okay? Make sure that you follow the homepage and the blogs and all that. I'll talk about in a minute. Okay. What I'm going to do in the next couple of slides is first actually give you the administrative stuff. Okay, but unfortunately, much of this won't probably make too much sense until you suddenly start realizing towards the middle of the semester, oh my God, what am I supposed to be graded on? And at that time, you should come back and look at this. Okay. And also, I'm recording myself. So you can actually listen to it, you know, if you are still having questions about how you're going to be graded. Okay, so that's the grading ideas here. You're going to have projects, you're going to have homeworks, and we're going to have TEF. Okay, there are going to be about 4 projects. Several of the programming projects are going to be in, you're going to do them in Lisp. I'll say a little more about Lisp in a minute. Not all programming projects require Lisp. Some of them actually require just using existing tools, like for example the BaseNet tools and so on. The only expected background as far as the programming is concerned is competence in Lisp programming. We will talk a little bit more about whether you want, if you want to do programming in other kind of languages, what your options are. I'll mention that in a minute. There are going to be about 4 homeworks that are going to be given during the semester. As I complete a topic, I will put up problems on that, and every once in a while, I'll give you a 1-week notice and say the homework is going to be due. Okay? So you're just supposed to keep track of the homework pane in the web page. So there's going to be like, there's going to be a homework 1, for example. And then whenever I add things, whenever I had problems, I let you know. One of the projects that you actually do have already is assignment 0. It's just a Lisp refresher, and this should be changed too. For some reason, it's in the wrong direction, but it's going to be due 2 weeks from now. Let me see. I think it should say that. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, 29th January. It's going to be due 29th January. Okay. And then this is really not so much about AI as it is about for you to get used to getting the Lisp stuff set up and, you know, doing a couple of programs on that. By the way, if you have questions, stop me. Okay. And then participation, and then they're going to be, I must have said somewhere the test. Oh, there, okay. Midterm and final are going to be there. The midterm, a tentative date is going to be the Tuesday after the spring break, so that you can enjoy the spring break and come back and do the midterm. So, and then there's going to be a final. The final is, the date is given. I put it up on the web page, and that's just the university provided final time. Okay. And then participation, you're supposed to show up for all the classes. No exceptions, I'll talk about in a minute. If in fact you plan to break your leg, you should let me know beforehand that you will not be able to come that day. But in general, if I don't show up to the class, I'll let you know beforehand. And the same thing from your side, okay? So that's the deal. And please do ask questions. And then I set up a class blog. About 15 of you already registered onto the blog, and you guys got huge brownie points. The first 3 who got probably, you know, will get very good grades. But anyway, the rest of you who haven't yet checked your mail and didn't get on to blog, still you have hope. But anyway, make sure that you follow the discussions there too. Okay. Lisp programming, you're going to use Lisp in a box, which is a little thing that you can just download from the web page, and it's easy to install and use. And you should, if you, basically it comes with an Emacs based interface with a Lisp program. And in fact, for the Lisp, there are actually a couple of them that they give. One is CLisp, and that's a cheap one, that's a free one, you should just download that. Okay. There is also a link to a Lisp review book from the webpage. Actually, I think I can show it to you here. And there is also, so if you go to the course overview, there is the Lisp in the box. If you go there, you will explain, you'll see, you know, you get the base installer and you get the CLisp module. That's what you need to do. Okay? And then there is a practical common Lisp. This is a little book which, if you don't have to buy a separate Lisp book, if you don't have good one, you know, you can read this. This is good enough to get you started. Okay, there is also one more link there about the differences between Lisp and Scheme. I believe some of you have taken 240, have done Scheme. There's very, very little difference really between Lisp and Scheme, but, you know, in fact, Lisp is a functional language. So if you know any functional languages, then Lisp is already not all that different, other than way too many parentheses, which you'll get used to after a while. And if you are using an editor which doesn't count parentheses, you are in the wrong department, you know, in the sense that if you are counting parentheses, then you obviously are wrong, you're doing something wrong. Okay, you are, as far as I'm concerned, Lisp is the one for which I will give you for the projects where there's going to be a code that I supply that you'd have to extend. I will provide the partial code in Lisp, okay, and then you extend it. Okay, so that's how we basically support that. If you hate parentheses and you want to do programming in some other language and you're a hotshot programmer in Python or some other language and would rather do it in that, it's possible, but I won't support by giving you Python partial code because I cannot give you partial code in 15 different languages. Okay, so if on the other hand, you can take my partial code, convert it into Python and do the whole thing in Python, that's fine with me. But if you plan to do it, please come and talk to me beforehand. Okay, otherwise, I assume you'll all do this. Okay. Course demands basically your undivided attention. Attendance is mandatory, and if you have to miss a class, you should let me know beforehand. I've been told repeatedly, and I've been teaching since 1991, and I've been told repeatedly that this should be, any course I teach should be a 4 to 6 credit course. That's not changed the way I teach the courses. I just think that the rest of courses you're taking are 1 to 2 credit courses. So it all makes up for the fact that this is a real 3 credit course. Okay. So don't think that by complaining that it's taking too much time, it will change anything. It's already been said to me since 1991. Okay. So it's going to be time consuming, it's going to be demanding, and that's just the way it's going to be. Okay, and I believe that I'm paid to assume that the most important thing you're going to do for this whole semester is to take this course. And you can assume that the most important thing I'm going to do this semester is to teach you. Okay, and then we are all intelligent human beings and we'll figure out how to prioritize our lives. Okay, so I won't prioritize your life. Okay, grade anxiety. People get just the same sorts of grades in this course as they do in other courses, okay? It's just that they work way, way harder than that, okay? I don't believe in setting grade thresholds as 98 and above is A plus, 97 and above is A, etc. So I'll actually look at the cumulatives at the end of the course and then convert them into letter grades, okay? And so there is some uncertainty involved in that. You will not know. I mean, in fact, one of the weird things is that people will like to say, well, I would like to know what my grade is. And if it is 90 and above is A, then if you have more than 90, you think you have an A. Not to mention the fact that, in fact, that's only your current grade and, you know, your final grade may change. But I basically, to make you feel that way, I need to set up exams such that I basically would have to guess what's the maximum level of understanding you have reached. I refuse to do so, okay? There may be people who are way smarter than me in this class, and I shouldn't necessarily decide that, you know, if you know 2 plus 2 is 4, then you should get a C, okay? 2 plus 2 is 4 is just way too minimal a requirement. So I will pitch higher, I will expect higher, I'll basically would not reduce my expectations, and I'll see what you guys do, okay? And based on how the class does, the grades would be determined, okay? This is not to say that you should try to stop each other from studying so that we'll all collectively sink, but, but you know, you could do it. I mean, that's fine too. I believe that that's a great way to use your brain to actually, you know, reason with the rest of the people so that none of us would do any work. But my only point is, I am not going to set it in such a way that 90 and above is A, okay? But nobody has really complained about their grades in the end, okay? So that's not going to be the issue. If at all, you do a lot more work during the semester, but that's the way it's going to be. Okay, I do give all the plus minus grades. I love them. So A plus, A minus, B plus, B. I just wish there was a C minus too, but they don't have it. But you know, I will use all the grades at my disposal, okay? Okay, and then the only difference, right now the class has 33,471 students registered when I left my room to come to the class, and 10 graduate students registered for 598, okay? And I think there are more people right now in the room, but that's probably going to change a little bit. But The only difference between 471 and 598 is that during the semester there is no difference. You'll all do the same projects, you'll all do the same exams, you'll all do the same everything. Okay. The only difference is that the list of 471 students would be maintained separately, the list of 598 students will be maintained separately. These would be sorted separately, and the grades and grade thresholds would be determined for these, and the grades and grade thresholds will be determined for the 598. So you won't be compared to the graduate students if you're an undergraduate, and similarly graduate students won't be compared to undergraduate students. And you'll only be compared to people taking the same level course. And about the only thing I would do is to make sure that the thresholds for grade cutoff for 598 are not any more lenient than those for 471, because that would not be nice. So other than that, basically you are just two different sets of people listening to me doing the exact same thing. And then hopefully, if graduate students actually tend to take only three courses, so they'll have a lot more time, and they'll do well, they'll do probably more things, but they'll only be compared to other graduate students. Okay? And undergraduate students, if they have six courses, they may do little less, but they'll only be compared to other undergraduate students. So that's the only difference in terms of grading is concerned. Honor code, we are living in the age of web. Everything, all possible questions that can be asked on exams are available somewhere. Okay, and probably available, all the homework solutions used to be available, I just made them unavailable, but I couldn't stop Google from caching my homework solutions. So if you know what to look for, you might be able to find the old cached solutions of the homework. It's very smart of you, but the point is that the onus is on you to make sure that you do it yourself. Don't submit answers that you copied from somewhere. Okay, so that's supposed to be, unless I told you otherwise, everything is supposed to be strictly individual effort. You are forbidden from trawling the web for answers, code, etc. Okay, and if we catch you, you'll pay for it. I would assume that you won't, waste your time doing this, and I cannot say that I'll catch every possible infraction, but the only thing we do is if we do catch you, you'll pay for it. Okay, that's the basically serious point. Okay. Everything will be on the homepage. I'll try not to give any handouts in the class other than the one today. All class-related material will be accessible from the webpage. Homeworks would be specified piecemeal on the webpage, and I'll let you know when the additional problems are added. So if you are one of those more disciplined people, you can start working on the homework problems as soon as the topic is discussed in the class. If you would rather do it with the adrenaline rush of the last minute homework, you can do it just before the homework is due, but it's completely up to you. The slides used, these slides will be available on the webpage, and then the audio also is available on the webpage. However, you are required to show up for the class. Okay, that's basically all of this is supposed to help you get additional clarifications. I hate talking to walls with people without any people, so you have to show up since I have to show up. Okay. And then I do reserve the right to modify slides up to the time of the class, but the older version of the slides are available from the last offering, and you can always look at them. There's going to be AI hasn't changed that much, at least the introductory AI, at least in the beginning period, that you probably will have enough of commonality with those slides. Okay, and the one thing that I'll tell you is if you're printing the slides, avoid printing the hidden slides. Okay, I tend to put a lot of slides and hide some of them because I don't plan to, actually talk about them in the class. And so when you print them, make sure that these are all PowerPoint slides. PowerPoint has, a print hidden slides button, and you just make sure that it's unticked so that you won't unnecessarily learn a lot more than I'm asking you to learn. It's okay to learn a lot more, but, that's just a hint. Okay, that's basically, as far as I'm concerned, the administrative stuff about the course. For the rest of the class, I'm just going to do the overview of what the course is going to be about, and then start doing some of the introductory topics. So before I get there, are there any questions? Okay. So we should start talking about motivation for AI, and I like this slide because I'll give you a minute to read it. Basically, A, I think it's a great motivation slide, and B, I think we want to figure out what are the kinds of jobs that robots will be doing very soon so that you won't be preparing yourself for those jobs. You know, because I mean, talking about outsourcing, you know, if you're outsourced to the robots in the other, you know, in the other corner of the street, you know, you'll be in big trouble. So part of what we'll be finding out in today's class is what is feasible, what is not feasible with respect to AI enterprise, okay? Here is about my only motivational slide, presumably. These are two guys who barely agree on each other, you know, anything. I think, of course, Gates has already stepped down. This is by people from Google, and this is by Microsoft guy, both of who essentially think that the breakthroughs in AI are the very biggest things that can, you know, help the technology industry, okay? Okay, so course overview. What we're going to do is, this is basically the dry overview of the course. We'll hopefully look at this slide a couple of times, even today's class, as well as later on during the semester. And every time you see it, you'll have a slightly better idea as to what those topics mean. Okay. So we'll start today by a little discussion on what is AI and what would be the general goals of AI enterprise. This today's class would be the least technical of the classes that you would probably are most philosophical of the classes you're likely to encounter. Starting next class, it's going to be a little more nuts and bolts. So if you are interested in philosophical things, today is your day. If not, then wait until next class. Okay, so we will talk about the general goals of AI, and we'll also talk about a general architecture for intelligent agents that we will follow and make sense of everything we do in this class with respect to the components of that agent architecture. Okay, so those are the things that we will try to do in today, and maybe if we don't complete it today, then we'll do it next class. Then based on the architecture of the intelligent agents, we will talk about, there is a problem solving agent architecture, there is a logical agent architecture, and there is a probabilistic agent architecture. And for all of them, we will look at the details of those agent architectures and specific ways of actually designing them. Okay, so the search stuff, for example, will come under problem solving agents. Logical reasoning so understanding how reasoning with first order logic and propositional logic would be done computationally will come in this part. Then reasoning with uncertainty will come next. And then we'll talk about planning and learning, which are basically, again, planning is a sort of a search in the logical or probabilistic representation. Okay. We will also talk about how the knowledge that the agent has could be learned, and we'll talk a little about learning towards the end of the semester. Okay. So what I am going to do now is spend time on that part, which is basically most of what we're going to do today's class. Again, stop me if you have questions. If not, that's fine. So here are four, how many of you have read the first chapter in Russell and Norvig? Great, okay. And there was also this couple of students who actually said they downloaded the Lisp in the Box and tried out the refresher exercises, and I was really excited. I think this is great. And if you are not one of them, you probably should not, I mean, I guess the people who actually identified themselves, I'm worried about their safety. But, you know, let's hope that rest of you will also follow and, you know, get going fast on the Lisp side. Anyway, so I hope you'll go back and read the first chapter as well as second chapter, because those are the ones that we'll be discussing in today's class and next class. So here are, one of the interesting things is that if you take a certain course, you may or may not have preconceived notions about what that course is going to be doing. My experience has been that when people come into AI, intro to AI, they already think they know what it is about, and it may actually be about what they're thinking it is about, in which case they're happy, I'm happy. Or it's not at all about what they think it is about, in which case they really are unhappy. So what I'll try to do in today's class is look at a bunch of definitions of AI and talk about the ones that actually make sense as far as this class is concerned. It's not because the other definitions are useless, but only that we won't talk about those ways of doing AI. Okay? So here are four definitions that people have given. So this guy basically says, automation of activities that we associate with human thinking, activities such as decision making, problem solving, learning. That's what Bellman said, one guy. Another in this case says, the study of how to make computers do things at which, at the moment, people are better. Moving target. Okay? This one says, the study of mental faculties through the use of computational models. Study of mental faculties through the use of computational models. Okay? So if you start thinking of, and then this one says, the branch of computer science that's concerned with the automation of intelligent behavior, however they do it. Okay? So if you try to sort of, and then there are multiple definitions which fall in this category, or this, or this, or this, and what we can do is if you sort of look for equivalence classes for these, you know, if you try to give small descriptive descriptions of each of these kinds of definitions, there is thinking humanly. This one is really saying AI should be about making programs that can think humanly. And this one is saying AI should be about making programs that should be thinking rationally. And this one is saying we want programs which act humanly. When I say programs here, by the way, programs, entities, artificial agents, okay? They should be acting humanly, and this is saying acting rationally. Okay, so what I'll do is to go through these four and think of the consequences of what it would mean to make things, you know, be interested in making programs that think humanly. What are the consequences of that? What are the consequences of making programs that think rationally, acting humanly, and acting rationally? And finally, we will actually decide that, having looked at all four, that what we'll do in this course is understanding how to write programs or agents or entities that act rationally. Okay? But on the way to it, I'll also explain to you that there are other sister disciplines who are interested in understanding these. These are not just the definitions of AI. AI is connected to many other disciplines, and some of them actually have these as the goals. And we in AI too would be interested in them under certain conditions. But the best description would be to say that we are interested in making programs that act rationally. Okay? That's what we'll be doing. So, but before, that's the short summary of what I'll be doing in the next 30 minutes or so. Okay. So, thinking humanly. Okay. So, there is, this is basically the idea of understanding how humans think and implementing it into programs. Okay. Now, the interesting question, of course, is, that, and there is obviously a reason to understand how humans think. For example, cognitive psychologists are very interested in understanding how humans think. Okay, because when kids sometimes have learning disorders, you need to figure out why are these learning disorders present, and how do you even actually diagnose that they have these disorders, that they're thinking wrongly. Okay, now of course the final answer could be wrong, either for a kid who thinks right but writes wrong versus a kid who thinks wrong and writes right. You know, the wrong answer was very carefully written down. How do you figure out whether, you know, their thinking is right or wrong? You need to understand how human thinking goes. Okay? Cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, cognitive psychology, these are very interested in how humans think, and it's very useful to understand them if you want to predict how humans are likely to behave under certain conditions. Okay, this is not a bad thing to do at all, and you can get into New York Times. In fact, you know, New York Times is always talking about how, you know, people are able to study how humans think. I don't know. Well, did anybody see a recent 60 Minutes show where they were talking about the fact that now people can take an MRI of your brain and try to figure out whether you are thinking about this particular screen here or the computer there. Okay, and they just basically do this by looking at the MRI. Okay. So it's an interesting direction, and it's sort of understanding how humans do thinking and how our brain changes when you are doing the thinking. However, in terms of as long as you're interested in actually making intelligent agents, they don't necessarily have to think like humans. Okay. So for example, do you want a machine that beats humans in chess, which is something that's already done? Okay, or do you want a machine that beats humans in chess and does so while thinking like humans? Okay, we don't necessarily, even if in fact the machines that, for example, the machines that the Deep Blue that won the chess championship many years back by taking it from Kasparov, it does not at all, at least if you ask humans, how do they do? I mean, if you ask chess grandmasters, how do they play chess? They give descriptions which are not at all like how Deep Blue operates. Okay, and in fact, we will talk about how Deep Blue operates, how game search can be done, and it's a lot closer to brute force search with some interesting heuristics. Whereas human grandmasters tend to say, oh, we look at the board, we see patterns. Now, this is also part of the delusion that we humans have, that if we do anything, we tend to think it's brilliant. Okay, we may very well be doing really boring search, but you know, if you explain, if people ask you how did you do it, and if you say, oh, I just did boring search, nobody will like it. So you would say, I saw patterns, you know, and it came to me, and in a midnight clear, and then I was able to see it, right? So the point, of course, is that at least if you give the grandmasters some benefit of doubt, they seem to be doing chess very differently than machines seem to be doing. Okay, and so the question, of course, is must you only focus on how humans think? Okay, and all we are discussing, all we are going to say as far as this slide is concerned, is we don't mind understanding how humans think if it helps. If it helps making intelligent agents. If it doesn't, if there is a cheaper ways of making intelligent agents, we'll go with that. Okay. Whereas a cognitive psychologist can't say that. They can't say, you know, I really understand how IBM PC works better than how humans work. That's not enough, because then they will take away their license. Because when kids, you know, when people come and you know sleep on their couch, then they can't try to analyze you as if how is your CPU working, how is your main memory working. They have to understand, the analysis has to be done in terms of you know human thinking. Okay, so my point is, it's not that it's a bad definition, it's just not a good definition for AI enterprise. It could be a good definition for somebody else. Okay, now if you cannot, so now they're thinking humanly, and then the same thing in fact is, you know, if you can also talk about humans are actually fallible, humans don't do linear thinking, we always talk about the fact that human thinking is, you know, lots and lots of flaws involved in it. And so one can ask, well, maybe if you are interested in thinking at all, we should be doing thinking rationally. That means even if you are trying to make programs that imitate thinking, then why imitate human thinking? Let's imitate rational thinking. Okay, now this is basically what Greeks have tried to do, and you know we are stuck with that from, you know, from then onwards till now, which is the right way to think. We shall legislate the right way to think, and right way to think, for example, is logically. Logically, and you can formalize logical modes of reasoning, probabilistic modes of reasoning, and then you know say this is the way to do it. Now, one of the weird things about this is that while this is actually not about how humans think, and so cognitive psychologists are not interested in this. Okay, cognitive psychologists are not interested in how to think rationally. Okay, so in a way, actually, this definition turns out to be not particularly useful for AI enterprise, because ultimately the other two, which talk about acting, are much more important. It doesn't really help that you thought right. If you didn't do the right thing, you're dead anyway. Okay? And if you at least understand human thinking, then you have a vocation. You can be a cognitive psychologist. Okay? If you just understand rational thinking by itself, it's not enough, because you know, there are the machines don't think rationally necessarily, and then you cannot write agent programs that do rational thinking but don't do any action. In which case, how do you know what is the use of that thinking? Okay, so this is worth understanding, that this is the other part of thinking definition, thinking rationally, thinking humanly versus rationally. Okay, so we'll shift now to acting humanly, which is kind of fun definition. Because in fact, people have tried doing this for a long, long time. Okay, so the idea is a program. So again, one of the things is the point about these definitions is that if this is our definition, and you write a program, and you say this is intelligent according to this definition, then all I need to do is to make sure that your program is thinking like humans. That's what I need to do. Otherwise, you didn't follow the definition. I mean, you solved some other problem. Okay. Similarly, if you say I wrote a program which, according to this definition of AI, then I need to make sure that it does rational thinking. It doesn't matter what humans think, but it does rational thinking. Okay. Now, this is actually an easier thing to evaluate. If you write a program which is supposed to act humanly, then all I need to do is interact with it. And if I think it looks like a human, I mean, it seems to, you know, interacting with this program seems to be very similar to my interactions with other human beings, then it's acting humanly. So I evaluated it very easily. So in fact, Alan Turing, how many of you know Alan Turing? Those of you who did not raise your hand, okay, you're in trouble. You know, Alan Turing is to computer science what George Washington was apparently to America, according to the inaugural speech that you just heard. Okay, Alan Turing is called the father of computer science, and you just have to know who is Alan Turing. Okay, even if I pronounce his name badly, you still need to know who is Alan Turing. Okay, so Alan Turing is considered the founder of computer science, father of computer science, and one of the nice things is when he started thinking about computing as a discipline and talked about the Turing machine. Right, the Turing machine, and talked about the limits of computability and so on, the first thing that he started thinking was not how big a Excel spreadsheet can Turing machine solve. They didn't think about it. It did not occur to him somehow. Okay, obviously he, you know, was not well employed, you know, in his later part of his life. But anyway, what he thought about is, can machines be intelligent? Okay, can, once you understand that the limits of computability, can a computing machine be intelligent? Okay, and much before any real mechanical computers existed, other than the little ones that he made for breaking the Enigma code, he started thinking about, if there were to be a machine that is actually intelligent, how could you tell? Do you understand? Okay, one of the interesting questions is, before you go on a quest, you need to know, how do you know if your quest is done? Right? I mean, if you actually made something which is intelligent, if a machine is intelligent, is there a way you can tell that by some objective test? Okay, so he wrote a very nice paper, and where basically he argued very tightly as to what would be the right way to figure out whether or not a machine can be seen to be, can be said to be intelligent. Okay, and then he came up with this test that has later been called the Turing test. Okay, what's a Turing test? Basically, his idea was that humans will talk to these quote-unquote intelligent machines, agents, you know, non-human entities, from behind a screen. Okay, probably in some medium which would not give away the identity. So, for example, keyboard typing or something, and then they just can have completely freewheeling conversation. Completely freewheeling conversation, and if after a bunch of this time, if humans decide that look, you know, the person, the thing on the other side, is human, then it's human. You know, this is basically, if it, what looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's duck. philosophy of intelligence. Okay, if all of us think that this program is acting intelligently, then it is intelligent. Okay, why? Because it's actually very hard to define what intelligence is, other than, you know, we saying that, you know, we are talking to other humans and we think that they are, you know, we are having intelligent conversation. If I later on point out that that's a program, then you must say, wow, that program must be intelligent. This was his idea. Okay. Now, when Turing came up with this idea, he expected a wide, freewheeling, wide-ranging conversation, the way humans have, you know, when they don't necessarily say, now shall we talk about the inaugural address, and then for the next 15 minutes until I, you know, say beep, we will still be talking about inaugural address, and if you suddenly want to go to McDonald's, you can't talk about that in the middle. Okay? We don't say that when we are talking. We can change conversation completely and we follow each other. So that's what Turing had in mind. Okay? Now, in fact, there are all sorts of interesting questions that you can have about whether Turing test is a reasonable measure of intelligence. And I hope you will have some, and I'll ask you to, you know, share your opinions on the blog, or you can say it now too, but, you know, definitely on the blog. Okay. But this was a reasonable test for checking whether this is a human, you know, whether it's acting humanly. There was this guy called Loebner who, for a while, you know, he was a Boston industrialist, I believe, who made good enough money, and he decided that he will essentially hold a Turing test competition every year. Okay, except to make things feasible, he would say that people will come and they will actually say that we have this program, and that program essentially, they will say it only talks about inaugural address, it only talks about Shakespeare. Okay, so once you decide the, you know, conversation topic, then people can have conversation with it, and if people are people wind up thinking overall that this looks like a human being, then it's an intelligent machine. Okay. Now, to make things interesting, what they do, of course, is a whole bunch of people in Boston will show up, and during this competition, behind the screen, sometimes there are real humans who will say we'll only talk about Shakespeare, and sometimes there are real machines who will say we'll only talk about inaugural address. And what you're supposed to do is, these people who have this conversation are supposed to tick, saying, I think this is a human, I think this is a machine. Okay, and then by the end of the whatever 3-day, 4-day competition, whichever machine wound up getting large number of it's a human being kind of comments wins the competition. Okay, and then again we'll do it next year with slightly better ideas. Okay, now one of the interesting things of course is that so in the case of Loebner competition, at least one year there was this one guy who, a person who was the placebo guys, in the sense, you know, apart from the machine, sometimes there'll be humans on this side, right? And this human happened to be a Shakespearean scholar, and he would have conversations with anybody who wants from on this side, you know, on Shakespearean literature. And a whole bunch of people who had conversations with this guy said, must be a machine. You know, nobody who is real would have this kind of nonsensical information about the details of Shakespeareana. Okay? Must be a machine, all right? So what does that tell us? So of course that guy, you know, was probably demoted or promoted to machinedom after that competition. But the bigger point is, it's not just beauty that is in the eye of the beholder, as Shakespeare would have said. Even intelligence is in the eye of the beholder. Okay, we can start seeing human forms everywhere. You know, the Shroud of Turin, the Mother Mary, and the, you know, what is that thing, the bread fly. Okay, we see human forms and human intelligence everywhere. Okay, and sometimes we consider humans to be machines. He's just a machine, he has no feelings. Okay, so obviously that particular point is that, you know, Loebner test actually stopped after some number of years. I think it went on in the mid-90s. Now it's no longer conducted, and part of it was because it was not at all clear that we can actually tell by interaction whether or not the, you know, entity is intelligent machine or intelligent human. Okay. Now one might say that even if that is the case, so this looks as if we should not basically, this point is only to say that checking whether somebody is intelligent by checking whether they act humanly is hard, because it brings in a lot of our own predisposed and preconceived notions about what it means to be human and intelligent. Okay, but does it also tell us that we shouldn't be writing programs whose main aim is to act humanly? Does not necessarily, because not until now have I said that you shouldn't write such programs. Okay. However, one of the interesting things is, if the reason you are acting humanly is because humans are intelligent, and so if you act humanly, you too, that means your program too can be intelligent. If that is the reason you are trying to focus on acting humanly for your programs, that is a funny idea, because when we wanted to make machines that fly, the first thing that we saw that was flying around us was birds, and they were flapping wings. Okay, and if, in fact, you know, first few ideas for mechanical flight also had flapping wings, and you don't see many flapping wings planes now. Why? Because that turned out to be, in fact, right now it's again back into circulation in trying to make micro flights, you know, very small flight, you know, things that can fly without needing a, you know, 8 mile runway plus Hudson River on the side. You would need, you might need to actually emulate the bird flight. But as far as you going from here to Hawaii is concerned, it can be done much better by just having fixed wing planes. Okay, so it's not necessary that you must act like humans to be intelligent. Okay. However, there is one little exception to this. One of the things is, if you make these projects, if you make these programs that will try to be intelligent, one question we will talk about a lot in this course is knowledge engineering. Okay, because all these programs will wind up needing a huge amount of knowledge about the world in which they operate in. Apart from the inference, apart from the learning, apart from the planning, etc., they need a whole bunch of knowledge that's actually input to them. Okay. What is the kind of knowledge I'm talking about? That is the kind of knowledge I was checking on the first question today, which was, you know, if Magellan went around the world 3 times, and on one of his trips he died, which trip did he die in? Okay. A, I hope that all of you got the third trip. Okay. I mean, I would be very worried that if you didn't know the answer. And B, think about who told you that specific piece of knowledge. You never read that. Okay, if you talk about how do I know that Magellan died on the third trip, I don't even know who, many of you probably know who Magellan was, you know, if you didn't pay attention to your social studies, right? How did you know that he must have died on the third trip? Because there's a lot of common sense knowledge. We don't talk about people traveling after they are dead. They would be taken on a hearse, but, you know, they are not traveling. They're not having fun anymore, okay? And so if this guy traveled 3 times around the world and one of the trips he died, it must have been the last time. Okay, so you did a lot of common sense knowledge plus a shallow inference. Now, where did you understand this kind of information? This is the kind of thing that you know by the time you are 4 or 5 years old. Okay, some of which you found out by saying, yeah, this thing looks red, let me put my hand on it, and it turns out to be a star, and you cry and you say, I won't do it again. Okay. But there are many other things that, just because you look cute to some people, possibly your parents, they kept telling you. Okay? There's a lot of knowledge that they gave you. They stabilized the environment around you and they gave you knowledge. Okay? Now, you know, the amount of time that parents spend on kids, you know, trying to teach them stuff, much of which they probably ignore anyway, unless, you know, they come to this class and they have to do this Magellan question. Right, there is all this common sense knowledge that you are getting free from somebody who should have daytime jobs instead of teaching you. Right, they do it because they have this misled notions of family values. Right, now the question is, if you make a program for which you need knowledge, who are you going to get to teach your program all this knowledge that it needs? You? Then you will stop writing programs, because the first program you write itself will take 20 years to get through the college, and then, you know, you have to make the second program. Okay, so you need a lot of humans helping this program. What better way to, and would humans help basic visual basic programs? No. Okay, would humans help robots? No. Would humans help robots on which on their heads you put like, you know, little eyebrows and cute eyes? Surprisingly, yes. Because evolution has co-opted the heck out of us, okay, so that we think little kids are cute. Okay, other than, you know, a couple of, you know, honest people like Seinfeld, you know, most people tend to think kids are cute. Why? Because our brains are wired by evolution that way. Okay, so rather than making people also think that your program is cute, make your program act like humans. And in fact, there is this old project called the Cog Project, where all they did was there was this little robot which basically didn't even have a torso, didn't have pants, nothing, right? And all it had are eyes, looked like eyes, and, you know, big eyebrows. And it will move the eyebrows and look at eyes like this, and people are falling in love with this thing and spending like hours and hours teaching stuff to it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so if you want to do this Samsara effect, which is, you know, get other people to do work for you free, then you need to sometimes understand how humans act. So humans show, you know, surprise by raising their eyebrows. Humans show anger by putting their eyebrows together. And if you do it the opposite way, humans get confused. And they'll say, to heck with you. You're looking at me. Remember, there's one more Seinfeld episode where this guy has bad eyebrows and, you know, anyway. that's the other thing. You may want to look at the Seinfeld episode guide to keep up with the course, because there's a lot of knowledge in that we'll use during the semester. Okay. So, you could wind up using acting humanly to your advantage by actually, you know, getting your program to learn, you know, a lot of knowledge from other people free. Robotic caregivers, the same thing. You know, if robots, I mean, because you guys no longer go and say hello to your grandparents, robots have to take care of your grandparents. This is like a big thing right now. Okay, I mean, if NSF is pouring a lot of money into elder care. And robots are going to tell your grandparents, please take your medicine or something like that. And now they better talk with the same intonation and sympathetic sounding, etc. You know, rather than just say, you know, with indifference, or if you look at some of the telephone answering machine, telephone voice recognition software, where this person will start talking in the male voice and then shift into a female voice and come back into the male voice in the same sentence, because they took pieces of the sentence from different people. That's not going to work, because your grandma is not going to do her medicines if you talk like that to her. Okay. So once again, for these robotic caregivers, you need to understand how humans act. Okay. So even if you don't want to figure out how to act like humans as the central goal of AI, you may want to do part of it, because you want the knowledge engineering, or because you want your programs to be able to interact with humans. And humans are very insular species. They tend to interact better with things that look like humans. Okay. Okay. That's the Turing test and acting humanly. Now, here is the interesting thing. One of the interesting things is because the last definition that we'll be talking about is acting rationally, which is pretty much the main aim of this course. So before going there, it's actually interesting to talk about this CAPTCHA project. How many of you know CAPTCHAs? Okay, good. So CAPTCHAs are essentially, I forget the exact computers, automated, something.
Completely automated to tell computers and humans apart.
Exactly. Completely automated Turing tests to tell computers and humans apart. CAPTCHAs are Turing tests. Except in the Turing test, you're trying to see if the machine is intelligent. Okay? In the CAPTCHAs, you're trying to see if the machine is dumb enough. Okay? Because there are certain things that humans are able to do very easily that we haven't yet figured out how to do fast enough using machine. And so, if that test is actually, you know, if you can give this test to tell whether what you're talking to is a human or a computer. Now, why was this important? Obviously, you know, you've seen these CAPTCHAs all over the place. Okay, anything, for example, whenever they say, you know, type these letters, you know, basically it all happened because Yahoo, when it had its email accounts, they suddenly found that they were getting like 10 megabytes free storage or something, and a huge number of people figured out that you can just get this 10 megabyte storage, you know, ignore the email, you just can use this as a free storage to put stuff there. All you need is, you know, a million accounts, you have a million times 10 megabytes. That's a pretty good deal. Okay, so they were making up this huge number of accounts, and so basically they came up with this idea of how do you make sure that the accounts, I mean, if you have to make so many accounts very fast, you can't be human. Okay, humans are going to be slow, right? And so you needed essentially computers which are doing it very fast, and so you had to stop the computer on its tracks. Okay, and so they had to give a test which can separate humans and computers, and anything that currently humans can do and computers can't do. And when I say currently humans can do, I don't hope that humans will stop being able to do next year. I mean, unless we, you know, basically atrophy in our intelligence. Okay, I hope that we'll continue to be able to do these things for a long time, but currently at least computers can't do it easily. Okay, it'll take time. Yes, sir. Yes, I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So the point, of course, is now what are the things that programs are unable to do? Okay, the easy things which when they started was, of course, these kinds of things, and you know, it was hard enough for the image processing software that was there available there. But it's an arms race. If you are going to test based on this, if you tell me what's going to be on the test, I will make my programs which will actually be able to defeat the test. Okay, and so of course, you know, many of these things can be, you know, in fact some of the increasingly it's a question of the level of security you want from programs, you know, coming into your site. Think of this as similar to cryptography. Okay, you have PGP cryptography. Depending on the size of the key, you know, assuming that there is no, the factoring still remains hard, okay, the question of course is how big should the key be such that people who are desperately trying to break in will still not have, even if the entire human, world's computing power is at their fingertips, they will still take more than 100 years or so to break. Do you want 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years? Depending on that, you say 64-bit, 128-bit, any number of bits to increase the difficulty of factorization. Similarly, but as you do this, the encryption and the decryption are also becoming harder. Okay, and similarly here, this, ET76. But these days, the things that Google shows me, I need to put on my glasses, look this side, look that side, and then they will also have this, the disabled person thing. I click on that and, you know, they'll give me other tests to make up for my, you know, inability to see things. The point, of course, is they're trying to stop people from breaking through. Okay, now what else can the computers not do? Things like this, you know, tell me what is in this picture. And all of you would say the snake. I mean, those of you who can see this picture will say the snake, right? Now, it's not an easy thing to do for computers as of today. So anything that computers can't do right now, and computers wind up doing these kinds of tasks basically because AI people will work on this. Because, you know, these are all things that are supposed to be intelligent tasks. Being able to see things, being able to read, being able to have conversations, these are all kinds of intelligence, right? So I would like to think that unlike other fields, what AI can do is just as useful as what AI can't do. So all you need to do is you need to tell Google that, look, you pay me so that I won't take this course, you know, and I won't make good AI programs. Because if you make good AI programs to some extent, these kinds of things can be broken. Okay. Now, of course, there is an interesting story behind this too. That when originally these kinds of captures came into being, now of course it was hard for programs to be able to decode this quickly enough, right? While humans can do it. So one idea that people actually did apparently was to open the window in one place, take this picture and paint it on another program somewhere else where you know humans are looking at it. and ask them to type what it is in a window. And whatever they type, type here. To do this, you need eager human beings here who are desperately trying to get in. So they did this for pornographic sites. Okay? So people are like really trying to get in, and they say, before you get to see the goodies, please type what you see. And so they were thinking, my God, even pornographic sites are being serious these days, and you are working, and all they're doing is they're taking the stuff from there and putting it in this, and this is all real time. Okay? Nice arms race. Okay? This, to me, is like the best example of the Tamsar painting the fence by actually you getting somebody else to do your work for free in this particular case. Okay? But that's not so much about AI, but that, you know, in fact, you could actually use humans to pass the human test. In fact, one of the interesting things is if you do not put enough parameters on what the enterprise of AI is supposed to be, and all you say is generate an intelligent agent. Okay? And I think Werner von Braun, the guy who did the first rocket, is said to have said that the cheapest way of mass producible intelligence still turns out to be something that you learned in junior high school, having babies. Okay? Because they come in and they can learn and you don't need to do much. Okay? However, we are assuming that we are going to be interested in making artificial agents, in our particular case computer programs, which can actually think, which can actually show intelligent behavior. Okay, so what happened in this particular case was we are using humans to do what cannot be done by the computer task. And there are enough humans who have no other work to do this for you, in which case you can actually get it done. Okay. There are other ideas on that sort of using humans to do intelligent processing. You know, I guess there is the ESP game. How many of you know ESP game? Okay, that in fact, if you look at the Google images, you can actually play there too. You know, basically annotating images by saying what is in it in English, so that then if enough annotations are there, then you can look at images by just textual description. Okay, and the interesting thing, of course, is how to get humans to do this for you free. And there's a beautiful idea in the ESP game where they made it into a game where the same exact picture is shown to two random people who log into this game from two completely different places. And they are asked to type the keywords that come into their mind. And whenever a keyword appears in both the lists, that's going to be very likely to be an actual description of this picture. Okay, if you ask one person, they can mess with the program. They can start saying all sorts of stuff that's not there. But if you have two randomly chosen people who just, you know, happen to log on without any collusion, and they started saying things, right, and then there is actual intersection in their list, in their keywords, then that must be a good description of what is in the picture. Now, of course, why do people do it? Because they were given points. If you ever actually get common things, you get points. And people like points. Okay? I mean, it's just you don't know, but it's one of those evolutionary things, I guess, that we like points. And then people get points, and they get lots of points. And in fact, in this game, this guy was saying they had to stop some people from playing because they were not having other life. You know, they were just all the time playing this game. You know, so they had to stop them from playing after a while. Okay. So that's regarding using humans itself to show intelligence. But coming back to our main course, which is again the definitions, so we decided that thinking humanly doesn't make too much sense. It makes sense for cognitive psychology, but not necessarily for us. Thinking rationally wouldn't make sense unless you also act based on that thinking. Acting humanly is not in itself the central goal. It could be useful. But the thing that we will agree on, essentially, for this course, and you can argue with me, on the blog, that we will look at acting rationally as the definition of what we're trying to do. Okay? If to act rationally, you wind up having to think like humans, you wind up having to act like humans, then so be it. If you can do so without that, that's also fine. Okay? So agents acting rationally, rational behavior is doing the right thing. This is like a, you know, the question, of course, much of what we will try to do is to try and, you know, put in formal terms what it means to act rationally, okay, in as the course goes on. Okay. So rational behavior is doing the right thing at the right time, and the right thing, that which is expected to maximize your goal achievement given the available information that you have. Okay. And then it doesn't necessarily involve thinking. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Okay. This is why if you say thinking is important, then if you are on the rural road or on the university and you are deciding right in the middle of the road, shall I cross the rest of the road or not, you're thinking very carefully. At some point of time, you may not be there to complete the thinking because you're already hit by a train also these days, you know, but previously just buses and cars, right? And so sometimes the right thing to do is not think and just act. But at the same time, sometimes not thinking and acting reflexively would be the wrong thing. And ultimately, the way you'll figure this out is whether the first, the agent, the program which was doing, the program that winds up achieving its goals more of the time, achieving it higher score on a performance metric more of the time, is doing the right thing. That's all we're going to say. Okay? And so, in fact, one of the biggest issues that we will talk about later on too is how much thinking are you supposed to do before you start acting? Okay, there is a word for it. It's called the deliberation scheduling. Okay, and you have this problem, you know, when you have a 1.5 hour exam and there are a whole bunch of questions, and at some particular question you are stuck. How long are you going to think before you skip this and go to something else? Now, you may think until the entire time and do that one question right, but you would be not doing as well on the exam compared to somebody else who just skipped over this question and did the other one. Okay? It's a computationally hard problem as to figuring out how much thinking to do before you start acting. In the exam, the writing is the acting part. Okay? So, it may or may not involve thinking, but ultimately it's judged based on a performance metric that's set outside of you. Okay? You cannot decide your performance metric. So, for example, in this kind of an exam scenario, you know, after the exams are given, you know, you would say you got 2 points, your friend has got, you know, 98 points, you know, you could say, I actually really wanted just the 2 points because I need the satisfaction of doing one problem right as against doing the easy problem. That is not going to work, okay? Unless I told you beforehand that this is the hardest problem, okay? There are, in fact, you know, just changing the topic a little minute, but there are, in fact, sometimes when an exam is given, you know, we, the teachers, may not necessarily realize that a particular question is going to be much harder than the other question for this particular population. And we'll know it afterwards. So I always have, you know, a soft spot for the person, the student, who did write the one problem that everybody else did worse on. So, but I still give them an extra 1 or 2 points. I'm not going to give extra 98 points, right? That's a little hard. But there's a way of doing this. I mean, in fact, in your GREs, etc., they do this too. They do, after the exam is over, they can do statistics on which problems actually were gotten to be right by the fewest number of people. And those in some sense are the harder problems, and they give a little extra weight for them. Okay. But you cannot, the agent cannot be allowed to say, this is what I always wanted to do. You know, I really just wanted the 2 points. So that's why the performance metric has to be given from outside. And the agent is going to be judged based on that performance metric. Okay? So now it can be argued that everything that you need to pass the Turing test is also included in acting rationally. Okay? If in fact, you know, if you actually have made an agent which can act rationally, and you told it that a goal which has a very high utility of passing the Turing test, then in theory it should be able to do what is needed to actually pass the Turing test. In that particular case, if you are supposed to act humanly to actually, you know, to get the listeners to believe that you are a human, then you would wind up doing that. So in a way, you can also say that this is a more general definition, and that's the one that we're going to stick to. Okay. what I'm going to do, so we looked at these four definitions, and over a complicated kind of a discussion, we decided that we're going to be looking at acting rationally as our direction to go. And in the next class, when we come back, what we will do is, I'm going to skip over this, to look at architectures of intelligent agents, which are supposed to be rational agents, and how do you actually, what are the pieces that are going to be present in these agents. And you are going to read the chapter 2 before coming to the next class. And before you go away, here is something that you can do. This is history of AI that you can read up in the textbook, some more history of AI. But this is a bunch of things here, and it's worth thinking which of them are actually already doable, which of them are not doable by AI right now. I can go over each of them, but it will take a lot of time, but it will be interesting for you to guess. Some of you know probably, you are also reading the same papers I do, so some of you know what things can be done definitely and what things cannot be done. Can, for example, can we have programs that can write an intentionally funny story? Can we have programs that can help navigate in deep space? Can we have programs that can navigate desert roads, let the cars navigate in the desert roads versus urban roads? Can we bluff humans in poker and win the poker competition? Can you solve crossword puzzles? Can you do an entertaining game of soccer? Whenever I say from here onwards, you, either you are the agent, that means an artificial agent that you're going to design, or you the programmer that's going to design the artificial agent. I'm least interested in your personal abilities to drive or to play basketball or soccer. Okay, I'm sure you're very good at it, but it doesn't matter to me. Okay, so think about what kinds of things are feasible, what are not feasible. I'd be interested in seeing any discussion on the blog, and then we can talk a little bit more about that next class. But most of next class is going to be architectures for intelligent agents. Read the chapter 2 and come back. Thanks. Yes, please, return the survey stream.